Good mornings, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today in the aftermath of last week's vote for president, in which some were surprised by the result, some were surprised by the margin of the result, the one lesson from the election that analysts aren't talking about, and that politicians still haven't learned. Also this morning, the Children's Mentoring Connection is looking to connect with more men as mentors for young people in the community. They have a special event coming up next week. We'll tell you what's happening. And recognizing the difference between lifespan and health span, and why it's an important distinction as we consider the lifestyle changes we hope to embrace in the coming year. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Thursday, November 14th, 2024. In the aftermath of the election, kind of interesting, one lawmaker in Ohio has introduced a bill which would prohibit homeowners associations from banning political yard signs. This is a measure introduced by 60th District Representative Brian Lorenz. He's a Republican. The 60th District is suburban Columbus. He's from Powell. It is HB 668, which, if passed, would allow for all residents in Ohio to have political signs in their yard, invalidating any rules put into place by any homeowners association or neighborhood group. That being said, it would not invalidate any municipal or state laws banning signs that threaten harm or aim to intimidate. So those would still be valid. You still could not do that. But your homeowners association, your HOA, could not prohibit your standard political yard signs. This has a long way to go before it would potentially be passed into law. The bill has been assigned to the Government Oversight Committee for further review. Stay tuned. I think it's probably a good idea. I mean, you know, it is the... I don't think an HOA should be able to restrict your ability to participate in the American electoral process. You know what I mean? This is a basic function of our society as Americans, I think, that we probably... And, you know, here's the other thing. You shouldn't be able to go over the top, maybe. I mean, political yard signs, one thing, but some people go absolutely crazy nuts with the huge signs and displays and all of that. So I don't know if there would be any reasonable restrictions able to be placed, but it doesn't appear that way from the text that I'm reading here in the story. I don't know. But anyway, it'll be a while before this gets to the point where we'll be debating it further, but I have a feeling that would be a pretty easy sell for lawmakers. By the way, speaking of the state legislature, state lawmakers also have approved a bill that would establish restrictions for public school bathroom use among transgender students. SB 104 passed by the state Senate in a 24-7 vote yesterday. It is now on its way to Governor DeWine's desk for final approval. The governor has previously said he would sign the bill, which would ban transgender students from using school restrooms that do not align with the biological gender they were assigned at birth. The Ohio ACLU calls the legislation a cruel invasion of students' rights to privacy. Okay, but again, easy sell, I think, in the state legislature, and the governor said he would sign it. But I thought this was kind of interesting. It says it bans students from using school restrooms that do not align with their biological gender. What about adults in the schools? It says students. I'm assuming it applies to adults as well. I would hope so. What else is going on? Among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. We mentioned it yesterday on the program. I'm not sure if it made it into the podcast or not yesterday, but I know we talked about it on the program, and you probably heard about this already. People Magazine has announced John Krasinski is the sexiest man alive in its latest edition of the award. This is the 39th year that People magazine has been awarding the sexiest man alive each year. They choose one prototypical male as the sexiest man alive. Mel Gibson was the first to win the title back in 1985. And this is kind of interesting, some facts about the sexiest man alive designation. To this point, and there have been 39, this is the 39th, to this point, there are now three individuals who have held the title who are no longer alive. Three individuals have held the title of sexiest man alive who are, in fact, now no longer alive. John F. Kennedy, who John F. Kennedy Jr., JFK Jr., won in 1988. Patrick Swayze won. I'm not sure what year. Let's see here. And who is the other? Sean Connery. Sean Connery. That was the other. So that's actually a really good trivia question you can stump your friends with. Win a bar bet with. What three Sexiest Man Alive winners, People Magazine, are no longer alive? Those are the three. Patrick Swayze, Sean Connery, JFK Jr. Brad Pitt and George Clooney have both won the Sexiest Man twice. In 1994, they didn't award the title to anyone. But in 2015, they declared Keanu Reeves was the 1994 winner. So they went back after the fact, 20 years later, and awarded it in arrears, I guess. Anyway, John Krasinski said he thought he was being pranked when he heard the news, but he said his wife, Emily Blunt, was pretty doggone happy. So I would say that's pretty good bragging rights, not just for the sexiest man alive, but their significant other, because you can brag that you are married to the sexiest man alive. That's pretty I can see where that would be a big thing. Once again, I didn't win. I was really disappointed. Elsewhere, among the first things that you need to know this morning, scientists in Australia. I saw this story on the Newswire, and it gave me a bit of a chuckle here. Scientists in Australia believe that they could reduce the number of shark attacks on surfers by placing lights on their surfboards. What they believe is that the sharks are attracted to dark silhouettes in the water. And so if you put lights on the surfboards, then the sharks would no longer be attracted to the dark silhouettes because they wouldn't be as dark. They experimented by dragging fake objects, you know, objects through the water. Sharks would typically attack the lures, but then when they wrapped the decoys in LED lights, the sharks ignored them. They believe that if a surfboard is adorned with lights, it might provide protection. And anyone, any surfer who has ever been attacked or bitten by a shark is saying, now you tell me, now you, can it really be this simple? Why didn't we come up with this before? Why didn't anybody think of this before? They do point out it is not a 100% guarantee, but they think that it would be effective. So everybody who's ever been attacked by a shark is saying, why didn't you tell me this before? This, speaking of things that will cause you great bodily harm, this is interesting here. A new study out of the Cleveland Clinic, they teamed with the University of Southern California for this study, and it says that COVID-19 can be deadly for years after you get sick. Now, again, we don't worry about COVID so much anymore because we're well past the pandemic. But this study is now showing that those who contract COVID are twice as likely to suffer a fatal heart attack, stroke, or premature death for up to 3 years after a COVID diagnosis, because we have about 3 years of data now. The risk is even higher for those who were hospitalized with COVID and or have a previous history of heart disease. Dr. Stanley Hazen of the Cleveland Clinic says there is likely to be a rise in cardiovascular disease globally in the coming years as a result of what we saw through the pandemic. So talk about long COVID. could raise your risk of heart disease, heart attack, or stroke. And it says we're going to see an uptick in that in the coming years as a result of the pandemic. That is the prediction. Wow, that's pretty scary. Good news, this is an unrelated story, but we always like to, you like to balance out bad news with some good news. A new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that several of the top sexually transmitted infections are now on the decline. After being on the rise for the past 20 years or so, the number of primary and secondary syphilis cases dropped by 10% last year. Gonorrhea declined by 7%. Chlamydia cases did remain about the same over the past couple of years. We got some work to do there, but STIs are the number of STIs are coming down. So there's good news. Yes, we have that. Always like to have, good news with the bad news. And lastly, here among the first things you need to know, most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. This is the time of the year we start to get all of those year-end lists and year-end data, like the number of STIs, things like that. But this is something that you definitely want to take note of. NordPass, the password manager platform for all of your digital devices, NordPass. They are out with their annual list of the world's most popular passwords. And once again, this year, it appears that we are not taking the security of our online accounts as seriously as we should. The number one most popular password for the second year in a row, 123456. That is the most common password that people have for, their social media, their email, maybe even your bank account. If that's your password for your bank account, you're in trouble. 123456. It is followed by the second most popular password is 123456789. Now, if you think you're using reverse psychology that, making your password something simple like that will actually make it more difficult to crack because the hackers won't be expecting it, you're wrong. Those are the first things they try, even today, because they know it's the most popular. 123456 or 123456789. Adding three more digits in numerical order doesn't really help. Also on the list of the most popular passwords are password. The word password. QWERTY, QWERTY, which are the first six letters across the top row of your keyboard, just going straight across. That's not good either. And then number five on the list, secret. If you're using the word secret as your password, it's no longer a secret. So just something to keep in mind. If you have any of those on your accounts that you still use, why don't you just go and change those right now? Why don't you don't waste any more time. Just go and change them. That is really not good. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Thursday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Rainy and windy conditions expected today with a high around 50. A chance of showers tonight, low in the middle 40s. The Findlay Police Department today will be releasing the body cam footage of the fatal officer-involved shooting that occurred in October. The police department said on October 28th, officers were dispatched to Bernard Park for a report of juveniles consuming alcohol. During their investigation, police say one of the males fled on foot and an officer pursued. During that foot pursuit, police say the teen discharged a firearm at the pursuing officer, and the pursuing officer returned fire, striking the juvenile. The juvenile suspect was taken to Blanchard Valley Hospital and later to a Toledo hospital in critical condition where he died. The Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation was contacted and has been leading the investigation. Get more in this story on our website. A former presidential candidate from Ohio has been tapped to lead a new department in the next presidential administration.
Cincinnati native and Columbus resident Vivek Ramaswamy will not be the next senator from Ohio. Instead, the former Republican presidential hopeful will lead the newly created Department of Government Efficiency with Tesla and ex-CEO Elon Musk in President Trump's new administration. The two have been tasked with making the federal government more efficient, eliminating waste, reducing the budget, and making large-scale structural reforms.
ONN's Jay Fox reporting. The Findlay High School ice hockey team will kick off the regular season on Friday night at the Cube. We asked head coach Ben Patey how the team is looking after some scrimmages.
We're a hard-working team, similar to the last couple seasons. That's our bread and butter, and that's what we're going to stick with. And I think our culture and our guys know that. And, you know, we're going to be a relentless hockey club that, that plays tough and keeps it competitive every night.
It'll be military night, and admission will be free for all veterans and active service members. JV will begin at 5 p.m. on Friday and varsity at 7. Get more of our conversation with the coach in the story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online at WFIN.com.
Well, you know, after last week's vote, there has been a lot of analysis and discussion about the outcome, why the vote broke the way it did, and what can we take away from the election. Our next guest says that there is one glaring lesson in particular that the analysts aren't talking about and that the politicians still haven't learned. Dr. Thomas Kranewitter is a former vice president of the Claremont Institute, former professor at Hillsdale College, current professor of politics at Colorado Christian University. And Dr. Kranewitter, writing about this in your Substack, you say that this election is kind of a case study in government regulations run amok.
Yeah, it's one of this. In fact, I would argue regulations. Let me back up here just a second, Chris. I've been studying the regulatory administrative state for 30 years. I've written books and essays about it. And it heavily affects the choices that we have. And in the case of this recent presidential election, it was decisive on really both sides, because federal campaign finance regulations, which I tend to oppose. If I had my way, we wouldn't have an FEC and we wouldn't have any of the laws and regulations. Free citizens would just do with their money what they wanted to, but we don't have that. We have an entire regulatory regime about how much you can give money. And so on the Republican side, what that meant was it's very expensive, of course, to run a successful presidential campaign.
Right.
And that means for most people, you have to raise small amounts of money from large numbers of people. It's very, very challenging to do. I'll give you one counterexample, the way it used to be. There was a very successful, wealthy oil engineer. His name was Henry Salvatore. He figured out how to drill oil in the bottom of the ocean and then became wildly successful. And in 1979, he went to his friend Ronald Reagan and he said, look, Ron, you're the guy who should run, right? Mr. Salvatore could barely, his English was very broken. He was not the candidate. Ronald Reagan was. And he said, I want you go run a successful campaign. You tell me how much it is and I'm going to pay for it. And in return, I want you, Ron Reagan, to promise never to ask me for anything. Don't ever appoint me to any, you know, position or anything. I don't want people to think I bought my way into some favor. And they made this deal. And now that's a felony crime.
Yeah.
Like what Henry Salvatore did, right? You can't do that. And so that really incentivizes people who can self-finance their own campaigns. It incentivizes wealthy people who might otherwise put their money behind someone who's a better candidate. It incentivizes people like Donald Trump.
So basically what you're saying is that for those who don't like Donald Trump as a candidate, you actually say we're more likely to see more candidates like him in the future, not less.
That's right. Absolutely. We should expect more people, more wealthy people who wouldn't necessarily, they're not necessarily the best candidates out there, but they have the checking accounts to write out the checks to themselves, for which there's no limit. And then on the Democratic side, you know, I, like many people, was sitting there scratching my head. I mean, I understood why Joe Biden was stepping down. That debate But, you know, then the obvious question was, so who's going to replace Biden? And when they came up with Kamala Harris, I thought, okay, this is very odd. She's a terrible candidate. She was out there in a crowded Democratic primary for an entire year in the 2020 cycle, and she didn't get one primary vote.
Right.
She's so unpopular. I'm thinking, why in the world would they do that? Ah, and then it all made sense. Regulations. Biden was sitting on $100 million in his campaign war chest, and Kamala Harris's name was part of that account, part of that campaign committee. So as long as the candidate was either Biden or Harris, either one of them had direct access to all that money. If it wasn't one of them, then they become just another donor. You know, suppose it was some other, suppose it was Bernie Sanders, right? Or Hillary Clinton or somebody else emerged as the new nominee. Then all of a sudden that $100 million Biden has, they're subject to the same campaign finance limitations. They can only give $3,000 of that directly to a candidate.
So they really had no choice but to elevate Kamala Harris, especially given the short time frame. They were going to need all of that money in order to make their case. And this is an important point, and you were just touching on this a little bit earlier. You're not talking about regulatory reform here. You're talking about the elimination of regulatory restrictions on campaigns altogether.
I've been opposing campaign finance throughout my entire adult life. I used to live out in California. You mentioned earlier as part of the Claremont Institute up there when McCain-Feingold passed, and I was taking to the pages of the Los Angeles Times arguing against this. Really, in the end, every form of campaign finance regulation, it helps incumbent politicians, people who are already part of the big machinery of our modern government. That's who it helps, because when you're part, first of all, right, our government has become so gigantic, so powerful, it's involved in anything. And so when a sitting politician calls a press conference, they get lots of attention. If you or I try to compete with that, if we go out and try to run for office and challenge them, we can't get, you know, worldwide news coverage just by calling a press conference. So we got to go raise money to get our word out there. And what all those campaign finance reform laws and regulations do is they make it more difficult for outside challengers to try to challenge incumbents.
Well, that's not a shock that, you know, the people who are writing the laws are the incumbents. So, you know, that's probably not a shock in that respect. But don't we need some sort of guardrails in the system? I mean, you cited the example with Ronald Reagan's benefactor not wanting anything in return and being very magnanimous about that. But that's not going to be everybody. I mean, more than likely, those big donors are going to expect something in return. That's kind of the exception rather than the rule, given human nature, isn't it?
You're right. And here's the solution is not more laws and more regulations. The solution is reduce regulations, reduce subsidies, reduce the size, scope, and cost of government. And all of a sudden, those in government don't have much to sell. They don't have much to give away. They don't have any perks for their crony friends. If we actually had a constitutional government that only did the few things the Constitution authorizes, then you wouldn't have all these, you know, wealthy individuals and crony corporations and businesses lining up to get contracts and subsidies and exemptions from ridiculous regulations and all, right? All that exists because we have this gigantic administrative corporate welfare state. That's, you know, if you sit back and think about, you know, if you're running a successful business and you're thinking, okay, we've made some profit, we can either invest in R&D, right? We can develop some new products or maybe hire some new sales staff or new marketing, or let's put money towards government, right? That seems like an odd choice. Why would any business go spend money on politics? And the answer is the return on that investment is crony favorite, right? The contracts and subsidies and all kinds of things. So there's the solution. Reduce all of that. Reduce all the crony corruption, the crony favoritism, And then all of a sudden, government doesn't have anything to sell.
It's a compelling argument, but can you really put the toothpaste back in the tube?
Well, that's the in a way, that's the challenge for the American. That's the challenge for us. If we want a truly constitutional government, that's the only path forward. We should keep our. I acknowledge that goal I'm describing. That goal is far off. Mm-hmm. It's hard to achieve, but we should be heading in that direction if we want to salvage anything resembling constitutional self-government here in the United States.
And of course, it all starts with the elections, like what we saw just about a week ago. Again, a case study in government regulations run amok. Really fascinating stuff. Again, Dr. Thomas Kranewitter, former VP of the Claremont Institute, former professor at Hillsdale College, current professor of politics at Colorado Christian University, and a number of books related topics that are really fascinating. Where do folks find you online? We mentioned your Substack.
Best place to find me is go to substack.com. They can pull up my name, Kranewitter. It's just like it sounds, Kranewitter, and follow me through Substack.
Dr. Kranewitter, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Well, you know, before you know it, it'll be time to start thinking about your New Year's resolutions. And every year, many people set this goal of embracing healthier habits. Well, recently, a new survey, first of its kind, called Habits and Health Span, revealed some surprising results about when and why people actually start living a healthy lifestyle. And so joining us this morning to talk about that is Dr. Holiday Durham, registered dietitian, nutrition science researcher, and product development specialist at Amway. So, Dr. Durham, you say it's about understanding the difference between lifespan and health span. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, there's an important distinction between the two. Many of us are familiar with lifespan because that's the number of years a person lives.
Right.
But health span is really the number of healthy years a person lives, free of disability and disease. And we know that the average American's lifespan is getting longer, but they're actually spending more years sick or disabled. And this really mirrors a stat from the World Health Organization sharing that the average American today will actually spend the last 11 years of their lives in poor health. And this is really concerning. But the good news is we know that habits can certainly impact both and potentially help close the gap between lifespan and health.
So it's kind of the difference between quality of life and quantity of life. And what did you find from this Habits and Health Span survey as it relates to this, as we are mentioning?
Yeah. So, you know, we found some really interesting and surprising findings in the Habits and Health Span survey that Amway recently commissioned. For instance, 57% of respondents who engaged in healthy habits within the past year said that they did so because of medical reasons. And, you know, the majority of these individuals say that they were advised to do so by a physician or they were trying to mitigate a health issue. Fewer actually said that they started a healthy habit because they had learned the habit when they were younger by a parent or a loved one, and they started it, you know, not out of a pressing health issue. So these insights really do underscore the need to be more proactive rather than reactive when it comes to our health and wellness journey.
Although it does seem to indicate that it is possible to change maybe some of our bad habits and instill healthier habits. It is possible.
Yes, I totally agree with you.
So was that kind of the main objective of the survey, or what were some of the other key findings, some of the takeaways that jumped out at you from this data?
Yeah, there was a few. We found that the majority of Americans, take one supplement every day and they want to know what they're putting in their body and they're doing the research. They're smart. They're doing the research on the ingredients, the products, the companies. We found that, you know, 2 out of 3 respondents are more likely to purchase vitamins and supplements that are traceable. And you might wonder, well, what does traceability mean? traceability is actually a way of tracking ingredients from the time that they're grown or produced all the way to the point that you receive them. And, you know, this really empowers consumers and they really value this. And, you know, they feel like it ensures quality. They also care about the environment. They care about sustainability and they want to know that the companies that they're buying their products from do as well. We also found some interesting findings pertaining to gut health. And that is, you know, over half of Americans that, you know, filled out this survey had suffered from gut problems. And in fact, one in three individuals that were taking the survey were currently having gut problems. So, you know, this is a very, a space that, you know, we need to learn more about and help people through. We also, you know, learned in the children's nutrition space that one in four parents with children that were still living at home were actually, you know, they actually had negative emotions around their children's nutritional intake. And, you know, a portion of these individuals were really frustrated. They were really, they felt really helpless. And collectively, these results are quite compelling. They show us that there's a lot of room for education, community, and, you know, most importantly, improvement.
So what is the overarching takeaway that you would want folks to remember when it comes to this survey? And again, like we said, it's coming up on that time of year. People are starting to think about those New Year's resolutions or their goals for 2025. Embracing healthier habits is a real common one that we hear year after year after year, which kind of suggests that maybe it doesn't take year after year after year. So with that in mind, what's the big takeaway that you'd want people to remember about this survey and about this subject?
I want every individual to remember that they have the ability to close this gap between life expectancy and health span. There's a number of things that really popped in the results of this survey, and that is that you can do that by making healthier lifestyle decisions and encouraging your friends and family to do so as well. And there's really strength in community. There's strength in numbers and in finding like-minded people. And that really makes a difference in people's health and wellness journeys. We also want, you know, people to understand that if you're practicing healthy habits, keep it up. But if you're not, it's not too late. Every day is an opportunity to adopt healthy habits, no matter your age or your situation. So don't get discouraged. And, you know, you can really, by doing this, really help close that gap between lifespan and health span. And for more information or resources, on this survey, go to amwayglobal.com and you'll find it there.
Dr. Holiday Durham, again, a product development scientist at Amway, registered dietitian, nutrition science researcher, talking about the first annual Habits and Health Span Survey. Dr. Durham, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
We interrupt this program to bring you a broken news alert.
Don't know if you heard about this, another story where the bomb squad had to be called in to a home in the area after military weapons were found. This time happened in Tiffin. Police say on Tuesday afternoon, the Toledo Bomb Squad had to be called to a home on West Perry Street after the grandson of a recently deceased man discovered grenades, mortars, and landmines inside Grandpa's home. What in the world is going on? This is like, isn't this like the second or third time this has happened in just the past several months? I mean, it seems like this is not the first time we have been talking about this in the area. What is going on, people? All of these people have grenades and landmines and mortars in their home. Who are these people? Grandpa keeping a secret, apparently. Fortunately, the bomb squad was able to safely remove the items from the home. No injuries reported. Apparently, most of them, from what we understand, most of them were inert, but not necessarily all of them. What is Grandpa doing in the basement? We want to know. Good golly. Good thing nobody was hurt. But I don't know. Ask your grandparents. This is not something you want to find, you know, as you're going through grandpa's things after he passes away. Maybe you should establish that Thanksgiving. You might just, you know, casually ask grandpa. You wouldn't happen to have any grenades or landmines in your basement, would you? I mean, anything we need to know about? Wow. Elsewhere in the broken news, you know, cops have heard them all. They've heard all the excuses when somebody gets pulled over for speeding or they cause an accident. People come up with all kinds of excuses, and cops have heard them all. But every now and then, you come up with one that is new. And in Pennsylvania, a man is hospitalized after causing a high-speed crash on Tuesday morning, Clay Township, Pennsylvania. The man's vehicle struck another vehicle before crashing through a fence and was then launched into a field at a high rate of speed. I don't have details on how serious his injuries are, but he has been hospitalized. The reason for the accident, his prosthetic leg got stuck on the accelerator as he was making a turn. That was the cause of the accident. His prosthetic leg got stuck as he was making, got stuck on the accelerator as he was making a turn, and then everything went out of control from there. That's an unusual one. Like I say, cops have heard every excuse under the sun, but that one is new. I'm sorry, officer, my prosthetic leg got stuck on the accelerator. Now, that's not an excuse that just anyone can pull off, mind you. I mean, you do have to have a prosthetic leg to begin with before you can use that excuse, but that one's a new one. That one's one that we haven't heard before. Speaking of police encounters with bad drivers, a police chase in California ended abruptly when the car being pursued went off an embankment and slammed into a forklift where it got stuck. Yeah, that'd do it. National City, California police say the crash happened just before 2:30 Tuesday afternoon. Tuesday appears to have been a very busy day. Just before 2:30 Tuesday afternoon, began behind a busy shopping center. They say the vehicle was reported stolen, and the occupants of the vehicle refused to stop. After a brief chase, the driver drove the car off of a dead-end street over an embankment where it landed between a wall and a forklift behind a strip mall shopping center. Officials say there were two occupants in the car. Both reported minor injuries, and both, as it turns out, had felony warrants for their arrest. So, they were arrested. Got stopped by, slammed into a forklift. Yeah, that would end that chase pretty effectively, I guess. Let's see. More automotive fun. This involving a moose and three BMWs. This in Sweden from the International File. Apparently, Victor Ortegren of Schmiedman, Sweden. Apparently a town in Sweden. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but I think so. Anyway, Victor was putting his boat into storage, so he had his garage open as he was putting his boat into storage when he heard a commotion and went to investigate. While nobody was injured, the moose that had wandered into the garage caused some $20,000 worth of damage to three vehicles that were parked in the garage, including one of them, a restored BMW. Ooh, a restored classic Beamer. the garage is a commercial garage repair shop. The garage shared video footage of the destruction on its YouTube channel, reminded people that it does not do animal testing on the cars that they service. Try explaining that one to your insurance company. I mean, try and make a claim to your insurance company that a moose damaged your car while it was in the garage. Yes. Wow. And speaking of insurance claims on automobiles, some people will try and make claims that are fraudulent, and this is not the way to do that. This has got to be the dumbest way to try and scam the insurance company. Four people under arrest in Los Angeles for an attempted insurance fraud scheme. They claimed that a bear damaged their cars, and we've all seen video of bears getting trapped inside of cars when they go searching for food and people have snacks or what have you in their cars, or, you know, leftover from the drive-thru or whatever. The bear gets inside, gets trapped inside, and then just demolishes the interior of the car trying to get out. So this was what they claimed, that the bear damaged their cars. The suspect said in January that a bear got into their 2010 Rolls-Royce Ghost and damaged the interior, and they gave video of the incident, submitted video to the insurance company as proof. That turned out to be their undoing, because it wasn't actually a bear. It was instead a person in a bear costume. And they submitted the video to the insurance company. The Department of Insurance reviewed the footage, saying they knew right away it was actually a human being in a bear costume. Upon further investigation, the department found that two other claims had been filed to different insurance companies with the same MO. Search warrant was executed where officials found the bear costume in the subject's home. They found the bear costume in the suspect's home. The total claims that were paid out in the scheme were more than $140,000. I would imagine that the guy in the bear suit is going to have to pay restitution. And they submitted the claim with the video with the claim. Yeah, not too bright. There you go. That is today's Broken News Report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
A worldwide organization that makes a difference.
I'm John LaRich with LaRich Chevrolet Cadillac. I am proud to be a Rotarian for many reasons, like our Polio Plus initiative. Since 1985, we've immunized over 3 billion children worldwide and have seen a reduction of cases by 99%.
To become part of an organization that will eradicate polio, consider joining the Findlay Rotary Club. It's easy and very rewarding. Go to FindlayRotary.org and click on Join.
This message provided by WFIN.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. In the aftermath of the election, the folks, the pollsters at YouGov have been asking Americans about their mindset, where they are post-election. We get into this lame duck period, or this decompression period after the election and before Inauguration Day. From a long slog of a campaign, this is the kind time we kind of take a deep breath and get our minds straight. So they've been asking people about, you know, how they feel post-election. We've had a number of the results from these surveys, and here are some more. This is from a couple of YouGov surveys. About 10,000 U.S. adults were polled between these two surveys, and they asked, how would you describe the mood of the country right now? How would you describe the mood of the country? 21% of those in the survey said that it is a mindset of we're all in this together. Right? Just 21%, we're all in this together. 57% said it's everyone for themselves. That's kind of where the country is. That's where more than half of Americans feel, like nearly two-thirds of Americans feel that's where we are as a country. It's everyone for themselves. 22% were not sure. They went on to ask, do you think that things in your life today are generally headed in the right direction, off on the wrong track, or not sure? 51% said they are generally headed in the right direction, which I thought was kind of interesting. 31% say they believe that we are off on the wrong track. But again, this is post-election, so probably the results were weighing on people's minds when they asked that question. 18% are not sure. So roughly 2 out of 5 people are just kind of holding their breath to see what happens next. And I thought this was also interesting. A lot of the attention is paid to the national election and even state elections. But what about locally? They asked, do you think that things in your city or your town today are headed in the right direction, off on the wrong track, or not sure? 46% of those in the survey say in their own town, things are generally headed in the right direction. 32% believe they are off on the wrong track. 21% say that they're not sure. So that is really kind of interesting. A lot of people are not necessarily sure that even at the local level we're headed in the right direction. Some interesting insights into the mindset of Americans these days. So the Children's Mentoring Connection is looking to connect with more men as mentors for young people in the community. To that end, they have an event coming up next week. In fact, 1 week from today, joining us to talk about what's happening is CEO Stacy Shaw, and also Larry Jones, who is a board member and a mentor himself. I understand. Which came first, the board member part or the mentor part?
The board member part came first, and then I started with school-based mentoring, and then I added on community mentoring.
So. So you've been through it all, and you know what this
is still on the board
about. Yeah. Stacy, talk a little bit about this effort to recruit men specifically. Why, first of all, why the push for men, and why is it so difficult sometimes to recruit men?
Yeah, great, Chris. Well, as you know, we've had a lot going on this year with our 50th celebration. Mm-hmm. And so as we wrap up the year, we really are out there seeking more men to join us in this journey. And that's always traditionally been an issue for us, is to have enough male mentors to be able to connect with the young men in our community. And so to that end, we're just putting a little extra twist on that. And next week on the 21st, we'll be meeting at Findlay Brewing Company, and we'll be able to have some appetizers, some conversation with some of our current mentors, which I think is a great way, and Larry will speak to that in a moment, of just understanding that it's not a huge commitment of time. It's not in reinventing the wheel, coming up with things, but what it is to be a male mentor. Mm-hmm. And so we want them to hear that from other people.
Is the goal to match girls with women mentors and boys with male mentors? Is that kind of the idea?
So that is the premise for our community-based program, yes. Mm-hmm. The exception to that is we do have some families also that mentor, and then we do have some couples that mentor as well. But if it's one-to-one, it would be the same gender match that they would have.
So when you don't have enough mentors, then that means that the boys that are in the program are, I don't want to say left in limbo, but I guess for lack of a better term, what happens?
Right. So, yes, those young men, they would not have a mentor during that period of time. Mm-hmm. We do have programming for them, however, through our what we call our PALS program. So that's twice a month we have group activities that they can participate in that is limited to the number of kids that we can transport and bring there that day, or if their family can bring them. Yeah. And then we do have sometimes we'll have some other volunteers who don't have a lot of amount of time to stop in and to mentor at that time, too.
So it's not as though they are left out of the cold, but it is obviously not the ideal situation that you want to place these kids individually with.
Right. Mentors. It's not that level of connection that we want them
to
have. Being that we're Children's Mentoring Connection, that's really what it is about.
Yeah.
And for them to have that person that's in their corner, that same person week after week that's reliable,
right,
that they're going to have connections with. And so 2 to 3 times a month is what we ask our mentors to get together with their mentee.
So, Larry, as you mentioned, you served on the board first. That's your first introduction to the program. What made you decide then to become a mentor yourself? What led to that decision?
again, I think I started out with school-based mentoring. In fact, I started out as a substitute for school-based mentoring, and I had so much fun, and I enjoyed it so much. And I'll never forget, they got me for the day that they were building something. They were building these models, and I am terrible at that. But they got me to help out. They needed more men, because, again, they didn't have enough guys to match with the kids. And I'm doing that, and I am bending nails with my hammer, again, and...
You're providing the entertainment.
The child I was mentoring, instead of saying, "Oh, that's terrible," he go, "You're doing fine, Larry. Just keep on working on it. You're doing better."
So who was mentoring who?
Yes, he was mentoring me, and that was one of the highlights. And again, just being around children, being around kids is just a wonderful thing. Living in their space in their world.
Is that one of the things that maybe speaks to the questions that you often get? You know, I'm not really good at that sort of thing, but you don't necessarily have to be.
Yes, I get a lot of excuses, and I say, guys, let's step up to the plate here.
Yeah.
My biggest question always is, what do I do? I don't know what to do with a 10-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
I said, do what you want to do, and they just want to be with you.
Yeah.
My mentee, we go work out. I like to work out at the gym. He goes work out at the gym with me. Loves it. I garden. He goes to garden with me. Loves it. Some of these kids have never done some things too that we just take for granted. My mentee never been to a baseball game.
Hmm.
And he started talking about the platforms people were running around on. I said, "You mean the bases?" He goes, "Is that what they're called?"
Hmm.
"Yeah, let's use bases from now on. No more platforms."
Yeah.
Never been to a football game. Want to know, how many times they hiked it each time?
Yeah.
I said, "You mean how many downs?" He goes, "Hiking sounds better than downs." I said, "But again, they've not done these things, and they don't have a male in anything you do, and it's not that much time." Like I said, Stacy has and the group have an activity every other week. I probably spent an hour and a half a week with my mentee.
One of the other things Larry's mentioning, the model making is not necessarily his thing. The gardening is, however. You take all of that in the process of matching kids too, right?
Right. So there is an assessment process that goes through the matching, and that we want everybody to feel good about it. So we don't look at a list and say, okay, he likes gardening, and match that way, because each one of them can learn from each other as well. So that's part of the exciting part.
Right.
But we do look at things like, do we have a mentor who likes more structure and wants to pick up on Tuesdays once a week? Mm-hmm. Or do we have a mentor that's like, oh, you know, it's fine. I'll pick him up on a Saturday. I'll pick him up on a Tuesday. Because then that helps us to work with the family schedule. Is a regular schedule going to work for that family?
Yeah.
As well as, you know, some personality types, those type of things. So we present what we know about the child to the mentor first and say, this is who we think would be a good fit for you. And then from there, if they say, yeah, that sounds great, let's move forward, then we present the mentor to the family. And so that they have an understanding, this is who we would like to match your child with. Because, you know, that is a big step for them, that they're trusting us to vet the volunteers that we have, because they are allowing them to go with them on their own. And so then if they feel comfortable with that, then we initiate that first match meeting so they can all get to know each other, which usually ends up after that for the two of them going for ice cream. That seems to be a favorite over the past 50 years.
Well, who doesn't like ice cream?
Right. I mean, that's
pretty easy one right there.
Absolutely. So even though it's winter, ice cream is one of those top favorites. They take and stop to Deets's. So.
Yeah. So, as we mentioned, you've got an event coming up next week, a week from today, Findlay Brewing Company, where people can get the answers to all of these questions. I mean, we kind of scratched the surface, and I'm sure you get lots of other questions as well when it comes especially to men, because, you know, as guys, maybe we're a bit more hesitant to open up in that way and become mentors. So give us all of the details. You're actually hoping for some RSVPs.
Yes, that will just help us with the planning so we have enough space and for the tours and things like that. So, but we are going to be November 21st. We're going to start at 5 o'clock at the Findlay Brewing Company. They're on Crawford Street. And so if you could just give us a call at 419-424-9752, or you can send us an email at info@cmchancock.org. We'll get you on the list. And it's a great point to really, it's just going to be conversation. find out what it's all about.
It's not a commitment.
It is not a commitment at all, but I will say most all of our volunteers who make that next step to say, yeah, sign me up, I think I want to do this, stay with it.
And the best part about this is, like you were saying, you can actually meet and have those conversations with individuals like Larry who have done this for a number of years.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Because I think one of the biggest thing, especially for men, is what do I do with them? And the other question is, how much time is it going to take?
Right.
And we have programs, I think people don't realize, that from occasionally stopping by and helping with our PALS program, so you're not directly matched with somebody, but different times you meet with different kids, to our community program, which is 2 to 3 times a month. And then our school-based program is weekly. But the beauty of the school-based program is you don't have to figure out what you're going to do. Our case managers plan that. So you just show up at one of our 8 schools once a week, and then we'll shoot you the information of what we're going to be planning that week.
Yeah. So all kinds of ways to get involved. We have a link on our webpage for more information about the Mentor Night with the Children's Mentoring Connection. Go to goodmornings.net for more information on that. And again, Stacy Shaw, Larry Jones, with the Children's Mentoring Connection. Thanks very much for dropping by.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. And once again, a reminder, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. Check us out online at goodmornings.net. You can also connect with us on social media, sign up for our daily email newsletter, and more. Again, goodmornings.net is our little corner of the World Wide Web. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow to finish up the week.